WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And last Friday, yes, it was Black Friday when almost no one was paying attention to the news, the Trump administration, that is 13 federal agencies working in coordination, released the fourth National Climate Assessment, a detailed document featuring the conclusions of more than 300 scientists that the planet is getting warmer, human activity is contributing to that warming, and we are approaching a point of no return in terms of catastrophic damage. It's a stunning document. It's also one that President Donald Trump himself doesn't buy.
I've seen it. I've read some of it. And yeah, I don't believe it. I don't believe it.
So then on Tuesday, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders doubled down, claiming that the climate report was based on hysterical forecasting and not tied to reality, even though it came from their own administration.
And you have to look at the fact that this report is based on the most extreme modeled scenario, which contradicts long-established trends.
Well, actually, I've read some of the report, and it's based on a number of different scenarios, some more extreme, some less, and even the less extreme scenarios seem to predict damage to the economy and much more. So if we're to give the Trump administration any sort of sympathy for the way they blatantly deny science, it is true that this report is not something that anyone would want to believe. It says if climate change continues at its current pace, the United States will suffer major economic damage more dire than the Great Recession. There will be losses from crop failures to severe disruptions to trade to major stress on critical infrastructure, even infrastructure that the president doesn't want to build. The report also confirms that a wide range of disasters, from wildfires and hurricanes to famine and disease, are the product of human-made changes to the environment. So we're not going to let the administration get away with burying this on the Friday of Thanksgiving weekend. We're going to come back to it here 6 days later and dive in some detail with Christopher Joyce, correspondent on the science desk at NPR. Christopher, thanks for giving us some one-on-one time here at WNYC. Hi.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Ryan.
So where do you start? Can you talk maybe a little bit about what I referred to, that there are different scenarios in this report. There are ranges of effects. If the model turns out to be true or turns out to be, you know, best case scenario, worst case scenario, based on the carbon load that's already in the atmosphere?
Yeah, I think we're going to have to get in the weeds a little bit, but, you know, warn me off if we get too far. There are basically, scientists tend to use four different scenarios, and they have numbers associated with them. They're called representative concentration pathways, but no, there won't be a quiz on that. RCP 2.6, 4.5, 6.0, 8.5. Basically, they range from 2.6 being, well, that's it reflects a world that really gets the act together and gets off of fossil fuels toot to sweet and gets into electric cars right away and does what scientists admit is a very unlikely, a very aggressive reduction of emissions. That's the rosy future out to 2100. 4.5 represents something more along the lines of what was agreed to in Paris at the International Climate Meeting, which is fairly aggressive reduction of fossil fuels, a fairly quick movement to more renewables. And then the 6.0 is a much less aggressive effort. And 8.5 is, as you mentioned, an extreme case. It is the worst case scenario, and that's the term that people use. Sometimes they say business as usual. What the authors of the report did was they used 8.5 and 4.5, and on a few occasions, 2.6. So they didn't use just the worst case scenario. But, I mean, as is often the case with people who are trying to deny the science of climate change, there's a kernel of truth there. 8.5 is an extreme case. It was used for some of these analyses. But as you said, the report, when you look into 1,600 plus pages of it, gives a representative range from which you can pick. And, you know, 4.5 is the one that scientists usually tell me to pay attention to. And that's what I do. And in that kind of future, there will be significant effects, economic weather effects, extreme weather. I asked them, well, why do you use 8.5? They often say, not very likely that the world will do nothing. 8.5 represents doing absolutely nothing since 2010. And that's already obsolete because the world is doing quite a bit right now with the Paris Agreement. And they say, well, we like to have a range that shows what would happen if Paris fell apart, if the world decided not to do anything at all. It's there as an outside boundary. And so they use it. And, you know, as you mentioned, the Trump administration is focusing on that. And there is a kernel of truth in that. But the fact is that the report does actually give a range. And when you look at the full range, it's all bad news. It's just some of it's worse.
Even in that middle range that you say is seen as the most likely, it's dire economically.
It's dire economically, although I think it's important to point out this is something that we decided at NPR not to do, which is what the New York Times wrote, was this number of 10% reduction in GDP by the end of the century. That is an 8.5 scenario. So, again, back in the weeds, that is a worst-case scenario. It actually does not occur in the text of the report. It comes apparently from one graph that was in the report that comes from a paper that was published in Science magazine last year that was a sort of a look at all the possible futures, again, using all these scenarios. And most of them clustered around a much less economic effect than that, around 3 or 4%. One of the simulations came up with 10%. That showed up on the graph. That showed up in the paper, in a graph, but not in the text. The text of the economics report said hundreds of billions. So it's not as if, I mean, you know, one can quibble over, is it 10%, 3%, 5%? It is serious economic damage. I'm, at least for NPR, we're not using the 10% number, but it's certainly, the number we used was hundreds of billions of dollars of losses from GDP by 2090, by 2100.
And even at that more conservative reading of the report, I think it's striking that it's framed in terms of economics as much as it is, because what I think we see from the president and from climate policy skeptics, let's say, whether or not they're skeptics of the science, they say, well, the question of the trade-off is how much do we want to reduce global warming in exchange for how much damage to the economy, because it'll cost us more to do things that produce carbon and other greenhouse gases less. And so here comes this every 4-year national climate assessment mandated by Congress, and it frames a lot of it in economic terms, that, you know, it would cost in crop damage, it would cost in lost labor, it would cost in other it would cost in damage to critical infrastructure that we would then need to pay to repair. And so I don't know if that's, you know, a political strategic calculation as well as a pure economic one on the part of the National Climate Assessment. But one thing that seems to me important here is that it focuses the conversation not just on the overly simplistic equation that people use sometimes of climate versus the economy.
Well, yeah, and one of the things that they did in the text, the authors of the economics part of the report, was they took a look at what would happen with the most worst-case scenario and the middle-of-the-road scenario, in terms of economic damage, and they calculated the difference. And, you know, there's going to be a loss even with the intermediate scenario, but it is so much less than it would be otherwise. And this is the calculation. I talked to some of the authors. They said this is what we wanted people to really understand, is that the choices that we make now, there's going to be some damage and there's going to be harm. We're already baked into a certain amount of climate change. But if you take the more aggressive course in reducing emissions, you're going to save a heck of a lot of money. And furthermore, what the scientists have been doing over the years, improving their models and informing them with more economic data, plus the fact that we are seeing the effects on weather, and which is the short-term version of climate, we're seeing more extreme events. We're able much better to perform something called attribution science, which is to say, okay, here's an event. It's a hurricane. Hurricanes have always happened. Can we attribute that event to climate change, or at least its severity? And that's a science that's becoming much more mature. And as scientists are able to say, yes, we can pick half a dozen events around the world now and say, like Harvey, for example, that we can all calculate how much worse it was because of climate change, then you can start translating that into dollars and cents. Mm-hmm. And so this gives an economic edge to the science that it didn't used to have.
My guest is NPR science correspondent Christopher Joyce, and we can take your questions for him on the National Climate Assessment, which came out last Friday, a consensus report among 13 federal agencies working in coordination. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. You know, maybe it's worth taking a step back when we talk about climate change, because I think we all know the basics of what makes the Earth warm up. It's the greenhouse effect. Human activity has increased the level of carbon dioxide in the air and other gases which slow down heat that would otherwise escape to space. But understanding how that trapped heat leads to these catastrophic effects is a little harder, I think, for people to wrap their heads around, because the report says human deaths will rise, insect-borne diseases will spread, wildfires will become more frequent. Can you explain in lay but scientific terms how an increase in just a couple of degrees Fahrenheit leads to such extreme realities?
Well, let's take what's going on in California, for example. When you get persistently hotter weather, even if on the average it's only a degree or two or three more than it used to be, but that also bumps up the extremes too. I mean, you know, the whole weather regime moves to the right, if you will, and the right side of the graph is the warmer side. And what happens in the air as it gets hotter and you get then also at the same time perhaps a drought, what scientists call higher vapor pressure deficit. So what that is basically the air is hotter and so much drier than the ground that it sucks the moisture out of the vegetation, out of the ground itself, and carries it away and turns California into one big tinderbox. And this is a direct result of simply higher average temperatures, even by a couple of degrees. It reduces the moisture level significantly enough so that California becomes more vulnerable. I should point out that the data so far do not show that wildfires are more common across the United States yet. However, large wildfires in the West are larger, so the number of large wildfires is going up, and the acreage burned is going up. So that's one example. You know, folks in New York, I'm sure you remember Sandy. The fact that sea level is higher than it used to be by about 9 inches it contributes to the level of water that came into the city that would not have flooded as much as it had just because of a few inches. Because when the ocean surges, even those few inches make a big difference over the distance it travels inland.
Let's take a phone call. Kevin in Belmar, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kevin.
Hello, Brian. It's really refreshing to see a conversation that's taking place about the science of this, but I don't think this problem gets solved with just the science, because it has become a political problem. And what I don't see happening is the other side, Democrats, and particularly highlighting the advantages of the other technologies that would be put into place to combat this, and what kind of economic advantages would come from those things. What we're doing is allowing the other side, or President Trump, control it by saying, you know, this is fake or false. There's no counter argument I hear coming from the other side.
Kevin, thank you very much. Chris, since you're a science correspondent, let me ask you a question about where his comment and your beat intersect. When we talk about the innovation from renewables to replace fossil fuels, this gets into something that even the conservative side says, which is that we are actually going down in terms of carbon emissions in this country because the nature of getting fossil fuels out of the ground has changed. We're not getting as much coal and oil. We're getting more natural gas because of fracking. And, of course, fracking has its other environmental hazards. But Trump and others will say, because of how the market is pushing technology, never mind the government needing to do it, we're already going down in the U.S. in terms of our carbon emissions. How accurate scientifically is that?
That's true. Emissions in the United States are down 14% since 2005. It's complicated as to why. Part of it is because we had a recession between 2005 and 2010 or 11. The major part because natural gas, made cheap and plentiful by fracking, has replaced coal. There are almost 200 coal-fired power plants that have closed down in the last several years. And part of it is because the penetration of solar and wind has been so much faster than people imagined that it would be. And so our emissions have gone down. In fact, emissions worldwide were flat between 2014 and 2017. They're going back up again. Whether the U.S. goes back up again or not remains to be seen. But it's that said, I mean, there a lot is driven by the market, but the market is fickle. Policy is generally not. I mean, the idea of policy, like the Clean Power Plan that President Obama proposed, would set the rules for reducing emissions, and that's that. What the market will do is wherever the profits are. If natural gas prices go up, we'll see coal return, and we'll see emissions go up. So there's that. As to the question of the caller, and it's a great comment, people are making this argument, particularly non-governmental organizations, environmental groups, and others as well. Obviously, people in the wind and solar industry are saying there's great profits to be made. There are great new industries to develop. We should get on board and do it because the Chinese are doing it, they make more solar panels than anybody. The Spanish have owned the wind business for a long time. And so it would behoove this country to get into that business. It's not easy to tell coal miners, go make solar panels. And that's true. And, you know, I mean, I think of the analogy of, you know, around the 1880s or 1900, I'm sure the people who made wooden wheels for carriages were pretty upset when the automobile came along because it put them out of business. And people are going to get hurt, and that's true. But in an economy where, you know, the government can make policy, it's possible to soften that blow and encourage the progress toward, you know, the next forms of energy. I mean, you know, we didn't switch from wood to coal and oil because we ran out of wood. It just became a better way to make energy. And so we can make that transition without using up all the fossil fuel.
Gary and Summit here on WNYC with Christopher Joyce, NPR science correspondent on the government's National Climate Assessment. Hi, Gary. Gary, you there?
Yeah, Brian, how are you?
Good, go ahead.
I'm a master's student at a program in Penn State that discusses policy and management for climate change and sustainability. I'm wondering a few things. One, what do you think of the bill that's going through court right now about children's right to a clean climate and one that doesn't involve climate change? And as well as if what your feelings are on the difference between a political approach and a policy approach between a carbon tax and a cap and trade system.
Two intense questions, befitting of a graduate student getting ready to go into the field. Christopher, you want to tackle either one?
Yeah, well, he's in a good spot because one of the leading climate scientists in the world, Michael Mann, is from Penn State. I'm sure that Gary knows who he is. Well, these are economic questions, and a little bit beyond my ken, I can at least relay what I read, certainly about the latter. The legal cases on climate change have not done very well. And I don't know that there's a bill, but there's certainly a court case from some teenagers. I think it's supported by Jim Hansen and a former NASA scientist. To sue the government because they're foreclosing the future via climate damage. It hasn't done well in the courts. It's still working its way through the lower federal courts. I think historically these illegal efforts to hold governments responsible for this sort of thing is pretty vague, pretty hard to do. On the other question...
Cap and trade versus a carbon tax. Now, of course, for people who remember 2008, both Obama and John McCain ran on a cap and trade system to fight climate change. And the cap and trade, it sets a total national cap on how much greenhouse gas emission load the U.S. felt it should allow, overall, and then the market could—that's the cap—and then the market could trade. So companies would actually literally be buying pollution rights, and this was done successfully in the 1980s and 90s when there was a hole in the ozone layer that was forming. For people who are familiar with that old environmental issue, and a cap and trade system on the kinds of chemicals that were causing the hole in the ozone layer. Worked. And so cap and trade was popular. But then once Obama was elected and tried to get it through Congress, Republicans said, no, cap and trade is a carbon tax. And of course, nothing got through. So yeah. Is there a difference between a cap and trade system and a carbon tax system?
The carbon tax system is more direct. I mean, you simply say, okay, there's $17 or $20 or $30 a ton on carbon that you emit. You pay it, and then that money goes to whatever. Either to help people who whose fuel bills will go up, or to develop alternative forms of energy, whatever. Economists tend to like it because it's direct and simple. The cap and trade is a little more complicated, and the fact is that it did work with sulfur dioxide, which was in the 90s, which was the cause of acid rain, and power plants did a cap and trade program with that, and there are cap and trade programs. Europe. Tried one after Kyoto, and it didn't work very well. It's difficult to set a cap. People don't know exactly. Also, if the cap is too high, then there's no real necessary urgency to buy credits, so the value of a credit sells for nothing, and so nobody bothers to get involved, and that's what happened in Europe. So it's difficult to make it work. And I think that's one reason why there seems to be more of a move nowadays toward a carbon tax. I mean, there are carbon tax efforts and proposals out there now. People in Congress are talking about them again. If I were to bet on it, I would say that a carbon tax is a lot more likely.
So we have, in sum, these 13 federal agencies working in coordination that released this national climate assessment on Friday, the detailed document featuring conclusions of more than 300 scientists that the planet is getting warmer, human activity is contributing to that warming, and we're approaching a point of no return in terms of damage to the climate and the economy and public health. Then you have the president as a one-man other side saying, I don't believe it. Are these Trump appointees in these 13 federal agencies who put out this science report, or are they civil servants? Who are these Who are these 13 federal agencies in human terms?
There are scientists who work for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, for the U.S. Geological Survey, for the various departments, the NASA, that do research on climate and weather. And I mean, this is part of their normal job. What they do, and I think it's important to mention that, you know, some of them do this research, but with this. This report is basically a compilation of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of scientific papers over the past several years. And they put it together and summarize what is the consensus opinion of the climate world, of the climate science world. And so it represents the state of the knowledge from everybody, not just the United States, but everybody in the world who's published and done research on this. I've talked to these scientists all the time. I mean, almost every day. And by and large, they say they're allowed to do, they go ahead with their business, with their research, without interference. In some cases, there's been moves to make it more difficult for them to talk to the press, not across the board, but in some cases. In other cases, there seems to be no problem. So, it proceeds. It seems a little weird that the people at the top then come out and undercut it. But then that's the way this administration works. They don't have much confidence in the CIA or the FBI. And I suppose no reason to believe that they would in the scientific community who works for them. But these are full-time civil servants, and they're there to stay.
Christopher Joyce, correspondent on the science desk at NPR. Thank you so much.
Glad to be here.